03180019 4 CR, State of Texas versus Reynaldo Lerma.
Wes Mao, the Hays County Criminal District Attorney, Your Honor, for the state, the appellant in the case.
Morning, Mr. Mao.
Josh Irwin, the attorney for the appellee, Mr. Reynaldo Lerma, present.
Good morning, Mr. Irwin. You all were both here earlier for the admonitions and instructions from the court, I take it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very well. Would that be the case if we're ready to proceed, Mr. Mao?
Thank you, Your Honor. Privilege be damned. That was the trial court's position from the very beginning of this issue to the day that he dismissed this case. The privilege, of course, that he's referring to is the informer's privilege found in Rule 508 of the Rules of Criminal Evidence. That rule provides a privilege against the disclosure of the identity of informants who provided information to the police. In this particular case, what occurred was in March of 2015, there was an informant involved in a controlled buy by the Hays County Narcotics Task Force at the home of a suspect in that case, a target by the name of Joel Espino. 3 months later, Joel Espino was killed during a home invasion robbery in which the defendant participated along with a number of accomplices. And Joel Espino was apparently shot and killed by his roommate, Andrew Alejandro, during Mr. Alejandro's attempt to fend off the invaders. The initial way that this issue was raised was when the defense requested information as to whether or not Joel Espino, the deceased in the murder case, might have been made into a confidential informant himself by the Narcotics Task Force after the information provided in the controlled buy in March. When the state affirmed for the defense that that was not the case, that Joel Espino had never been made a confidential informant, and this was, in fact, that theory was later debunked during an in-camera hearing that the judge trial court did hold. The trial court then raised the issue of whether or not the confidential informant himself from the March controlled buy should be disclosed to the defense. In their brief, and I do want to take this opportunity to address a number of issues that were raised in the appellee's brief. In their brief, the appellee points out that they had never actually requested that the confidential informant be disclosed until the judge raised the issue. At that point, the prosecution urged the court to consider Rule 508, that the confidential informant was privileged, that information should not be disclosed, without at least some evidence to show that there is a reasonable probability, as 508 requires, that that informant would be a material witness in the case. That was when the judge issued his proclamation, privilege be damned, and said that the information needed to be disclosed.
Wasn't the case, though, at one point that the state objected to even reviewing the file with the confidential informant's name redacted?
The state, our argument essentially was that at the point where the court started to talk about disclosing the confidential informant, there was no evidence whatsoever that the confidential informant had any material testimony to offer in the case. And so Rule 508 requires that as a threshold. Rule 508 essentially has three phases. The first phase is, once a reasonable probability is established — this is usually engendered by the defense making a request for the information — but once a reasonable probability that the informant may be a material witness is established, then the court conducts an in-camera review to determine whether or not, in fact, that person is a material witness or not. Once that's done, then the third phase is to order the state to disclose, and if they do or don't disclose, then that determines whether or not a motion to dismiss would be appropriately granted or not.
It just wasn't clear to me the timeline of events. It looked like almost the request was, we want to look at your file to see if there's exculpatory information without the confidential informant's name. The court seemed to like that idea. And then it looked like the state introduced, we need a 508 hearing, and took the mandamus up. And my question is, before the state pursued the mandamus, was anyone asking for the confidential informant's identification?
Yes. At that point, if you'll look in the record, what essentially happened there was the state was — I'm not sure if we expressed any opinion one way or the other on the redacted file, but the state asked for clarification. What is it that you're actually asking for us to turn over? Because the report relating to the control by had already been turned over with no mention of the identity of the informant. The informant was mentioned as just a controlled, or as just a confidential informant. The state then said, well, what information are you looking for? The defense then listed a number of things that they wanted to have, all of which were things which would have identified the confidential informant as a unique individual. And that was when the state said, well, if that's what you're asking for, then we need to have this hearing. Now, in their brief, the appellee has argued that the state should not now be allowed to object to the court's holding the in-camera hearing because we were the ones that requested it.
Couldn't the court hold one on sua sponte? I mean, do they need to wait for a motion from them to do so? To hold a hearing or to reach this issue?
I don't know that the court necessarily had to wait for a motion. Certainly they don't have to have a motion for an in-camera hearing.
Okay.
But the in-camera hearing, and the point we make in our brief, is not that the in-camera hearing should not have been held. It's that the original position that the court took, that disclosure of the confidential informant was appropriate on the basis of what was in front of the court at that time, which was essentially nothing, that at that point, the court could not then order disclosure. At that point, there was not enough to even order an in-camera hearing. And the cases are abundantly clear on that. Case after case after case talks about how, based on speculation and conjecture alone, an in-camera hearing is not justified. Now, I haven't seen a court that said that it is error for the court to hold an in-camera hearing in that case. But it's, of course, the in-camera hearing and what follows from that, where the judge actually makes the finding that there is a reasonable probability that this confidential informant would be a material witness in the case, that is, again, based on no additional evidence. At the in-camera hearing, and that's, again, we'll go to step two, at the in-camera hearing, the only substantive evidence that was provided to the court was the fact that Joel Espino, the deceased in the case, was not a confidential informant. The original theory that the defense proposed, which was then debunked. The only other testimony, such as it was at that hearing, was the judge asking them, well, if the confidential informant had then told the accomplice in the drug trafficking that was going on in that house that he had informed on them to the police, might that not have given that accomplice a motive to commit the murder that happened? And the police, of course, said yes, because once you start down that hypothetical road, of course, they're not going to disagree with that. The problem is there's no evidence to show that that happened, and it's not even a reasonable probability. Their entire conjecture is based on the idea that a confidential informant would engage in a controlled buy for the police against a drug dealer, and then go to that drug dealer's roommate and tell him that he had done that, knowing that the drug dealer's roommate was also involved in that same drug trafficking. That makes absolutely no sense at all. A, there's no evidence to support that that ever happened, and B, there's no reasonable probability that that would have occurred. Even if it did occur then, you still have to follow another hypothetical chain of events that after having heard that this controlled buy occurred, that the roommate, Alejandro, then determined that, you know what, perhaps my roommate Espino is now going to become an informant for the police, which we know is actually not true. And in order to avoid him informing on me, I'm going to murder him. And I'm going to wait until this home invasion robbery occurs and take that opportunity to murder him and make it look like I was defending myself and my home against these home invasion robbers. It's a ridiculous theory. But the court has found that that theory, which is the only one that's ever been proposed, establish a reasonable probability that the informant, who would know none of that except for the initial idea that he may have told somebody else that he was an informant, is now a material witness in the case.
Does it matter that this confidential informant doesn't seem to have been a confidential informant on the case at issue?
Certainly matters. There are abundant cases, and the statute itself, or the rule itself says that when we get to phase three, where the court decides to dismiss the case because the state has not provided the identity of the confidential informant, the rule says that the case can be dismissed for the charges involving that the material witness has evidence about. The only thing we know of that this confidential informant will be able to testify about is this control buy in March. There is no evidence whatsoever that he knows anything about the home invasion robbery that occurred 3 months later.
I have some confusion about why the state pursued a 508 hearing if it didn't know who the confidential informant was. In other words, even when I asked you the question earlier about why the procedure happened with the mandamus, there was a suggestion that, well, there might have been information in the file that could have identified who the confidential informant was, but the state's position later was, we don't know, so it's not an election. We're not refusing to supply it, we just don't know who that person is. Why pursue 508 if you don't know who the person is?
For a couple of reasons. First, because the privilege is not dependent on whether or not there's documentation about the identity. Second, because we did know some things about the informant, which we did provide, a general description of that person, his gender, his race, his hair color. While that's not necessarily going to be enough, I think, for most people to identify the defendant or the confidential informant, I don't know what the defense knows. I don't know what other information they may have to be able to say, well, I know there were three people that did buys at the house that day. Only one of them matches that description. Now I know who it is.
So, in theory,
right.
The idea is that there could have been telltale signs into someone else.
Right. The second concept there is the fact that the information is lost doesn't mean it can't be recovered. If the judge orders it to be disclosed and we later then find out who it is, that order is going to stand. We're going to have to make that disclosure. I can't simply say, well, we're going to waive the privilege now because we don't know, but we're going to declare it later when we do find out who this was. We were actively attempting to figure out who that confidential informant was at the time, and if we discovered who it was, I didn't want to have to disclose it because there had been no evidence to justify that disclosure.
Does the trial court have discretion to read Commander Parham's email and conclude that the email is an admission that Commander Parham knew who the informant was at the time of the email?
In my brief, I discussed that I don't think that that's a reasonable conclusion. I don't know that the judge doesn't have discretion to believe that. But even if the court does believe that, doesn't change the fundamental issue here, which is that there is no evidence that was ever offered to support disclosure of this informant. Whether Commander Parham did in fact know or didn't know who the informant was at that time, his declaration that they were declaring the privilege still applies, regardless whether he knew or didn't. And if, obviously, that goes to the final issue, which is, did the state actually elect, or did the agency elect not to disclose? If the court believes that they had the information and chose not to disclose it, then yes, they elected.
Well, so, and I may be asking, and as you know, I mean, these cases from this morning were kind of dropped in my lap yesterday. So if I'm asking the same question, I apologize. But on the trial court, when I was reading the transcript, specifically found that the task force members lacked credibility on the question of the CI's identity.
Right.
Are we bound by that? And is that last prong that you're talking about here?
That's just a better way of asking what I was asking.
No, and sorry. I think there is certainly, obviously, the trial court's determination on credibility is, I think, binding on this court. The problem, though, with saying that I don't believe them or I find that they lack credibility is that doesn't leave us with any evidence at all. If they testify to A and you say, I don't believe A, that doesn't mean B. It just means not A. It just means I don't believe what they say. It doesn't mean that there's any evidence that this informant has any information about this case that would be relevant to it, because now we have no, I don't believe the evidence that they tell me, but I don't know, I don't have any other evidence to say otherwise. It would be one thing if we had somebody saying, I believe this witness has this evidence and here's why, and I'm a direct witness to him knowing something.
Well, that's kind of how I read the trial court statements, though. I read them to be implying that these guys really know who it is, and so they're making the election for the attorney on behalf of the state by not disclosing even to you who this guy really is.
And I think that's true. I think the judge was skeptical about whether or not they in fact don't recall and don't have the documentation or don't remember who this person is. Again, the fundamental issue is not whether or not they have that information. The fundamental issue is whether the judge was right in the first place to order the disclosure of that confidential informant. If the judge was wrong about that, if there was no evidence before the court to authorize the disclosure of the confidential informant's identity, then none of the rest of it even matters. And that is the threshold issue. That is why it's what I think is so important, and I keep repeating the judge's phrase, privilege be damned, because he didn't care. The judge did not care that there was a privilege here.
But aren't you essentially saying that this guy wasn't a confidential informant as to Mr. Lerma's case?
I am saying that.
But yet you're asserting the privilege.
I'm asserting the privilege because he is defined in what the statute or the rule says is that a person who provides information to the police has a privilege not to have their identity disclosed. The second part of the rule is if the court makes a determination that that person is a material witness, the court can then dismiss the case that that person's testimony would be related to.
And you're asking us to decide this based upon your claim of lack of materiality.
Right.
Okay.
No, that's the fundamental position here. Certainly judges make decisions all the time on credibility and what the facts are that one side or the other is going to disagree with. That's why we have those hearings. But in this case, the judge did not say that here is what I think this witness could testify to. In fact, every single time I expressed to the judge in court that it is pure speculation, it is pure conjecture that this witness has anything material to say, the court agreed with that statement.
And so the confidential informant, I mean, and part of this may be for our students rather than you, but he was a confidential informant as to a drug deal involving Spina.
Correct. 3 months prior to the robbery at issue.
And then later, Lerma, who's been charged, was involved in this burglary home invasion where someone was shot in the course of it and is now being indicted for capital murder.
Correct.
Arising out of that.
Correct. Okay. And there is no evidence that the informant was involved in that. I see I'm out of my 15 minutes. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time unless the court has additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mao. Morning, Mr. Irwin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Josh Irwin. I represent the appellee, Mr. Reynaldo Lerma. This court should affirm the dismissal by the trial court for three reasons. Number one, the trial court properly held that an in-camera hearing. Number two, the trial court properly found that there was a reasonable probability that the confidential informant could give testimony necessary for a fair determination of guilt or innocence. And number three, the state made an election not to disclose the identity of the confidential informant. The state's first point of error is that the trial court erred in having an in-camera hearing. The only reason we ever had an in-camera hearing is because the state of Texas demanded one. We never asked that the identity of the confidential informant be revealed under 508. We received discovery from the state that showed a confidential informant made a buy from the deceased in this matter. We inquired about the relevance of that information that was provided to us. The judge ordered that the state needed to look at the file to determine whether or not there was any exculpatory information in that file. The state simply refused to do so. The court continued to ask the state of Texas to look in their file to determine whether or not there was any exculpatory information, and they never did. The state alone invoked Texas Rule of Evidence 508 with an affidavit sworn to under penalty of perjury by Wade Parham, the Hays County Narcotics Task Force commander. The state then mandamused the trial court, demanding that the trial court hold a 508 hearing in camera. This court denied that relief. In fact, the very brief opinion that this court stated was it was unclear whether there was any privileged information in that file. The state doubled down and mandamus this court to the Court of Criminal Appeals, urging you and the Court of Criminal Appeals to protect their confidential informant's identity.
Well, I'm going to, because I think the rest of it's really important. I think I've heard the state concede that there's no cases out there that say there's harm in conducting the hearing.
Correct.
So, I mean, you may want to move on to 2 and 3.
Thank you, Justice.
In particular on 2,
yeah.
Sort of what the potential information that this confidential informant that seems to have been involved in a 3-month prior drug thing could add to your particular case and indictment.
Thank you, Chief Justice. And I'll start by saying the second point of error, and we'll state that the court properly found that there was a reasonable probability that the CI could give testimony necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence when they made this finding on July 27th of 2017. The state of Texas never made a timely or specific objection under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1 or under Rodriguez v. State, which instructs us that in order to preserve a complaint for appellate review, an objection must be both timely and specific, alerting the trial court to any and every legal basis upon which the defendant should desire to predicate a claim. Maldonado v. State instructs us that specific objections are required to preserve points for appeal so that the trial judge has the opportunity to rule and opposing counsel has the opportunity to remove objection or supply other testimony. The state of Texas never objected. They never did it timely. They were never specific. They have waived this issue on appeal. However,
I thought that I saw them say, you know, please note our objections. I mean, and again, I read through the transcript pretty hurriedly, but I thought I saw them say that a few times throughout the course of the proceedings.
I'm sorry, Justice. I believe that there is no specific or timely objection made. I believe that essentially he accepts to the judge's position, but not a specific or timely objection. And again, we understand that the judge's decision in this matter is under an abuse of discretion standard, as indicated in Montgomery v. State. And before we talk about the actual evidence, it's very important to understand, first, Crane v. State, a Court of Criminal Appeals case, instructs us that on a review of a trial court's ruling involving findings of facts and conclusions of law, the trial court is given almost complete deference in its determination of historical facts, especially if those are based on an assessment of credibility and demeanor. State v. Woodard also states, Court of Criminal Appeals case, when reviewing mixed questions of law and fact, appellate courts afford great deference to the trial judge's rulings, provided those rulings depend upon evaluations of credibility and demeanor. Obviously, this is probably the best example of a trial court making those determinations for that mixed questions of law and fact, because no one else was able to be present in a closed in-camera hearing in which the trial judge did a direct examination upon the state's three witnesses. Just happens that this trial court judge is also a former detective that has the experience of operating narcotics cases, just as the three individuals that were examined by the court. In the hearing that was held and indicated in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, Detective Lenny Martinez conceded that the identity of the confidential informant could be evidence of innocence to the murder, and he even stated that the deceased could have been a confidential informant. If the detectives that were...
But didn't they assure you that the deceased was not a confidential informant?
He conceded that he could have been a confidential informant, and Detective Martinez stated that through his testimony, that yes, that could be the case. If that could be the case, if the two detectives...
Well, I should be a confidential informant.
Correct, but you weren't being worked by the Narcotics Task Force, Justice Goodwin. And so I think it's important to note that...
I think her point is, I mean, their answers were, well, sure, it's possible. I mean, is that really evidence that the trial court can rely on if a detective makes an honest answer, well, sure, it's possible?
I do, and I'll tell you why, Justice. When we look at Detective Grabarkowicz's testimony that he gave, what's extremely important is that he testified he destroyed the drugs from the Espino drug buy using a confidential informant before he even wrote the report and before the statute of limitations told on that crime. So if the state's position is that these people just blew them off, why would the state, through their agents at the task force, possibly convey a benefit into two individuals, not one? Number one, the confidential informant that they have working for them, but number two, a drug dealer, Mr. Espino. I guess I should advise my clients that if the task force gets a hold of you and wants you to work for them, you should just blow them off, because they'll destroy the drugs and they won't file any charges. That's simply not logical. The way that a task force works is that they work their way up a food chain. They take one witness and work their way up. Typically in a case like this, if a drug dealer is foolish enough to make a controlled buy to a confidential informant, they become a confidential informant. They don't get their information destroyed, they don't get their drugs destroyed, and they don't get a pass on their criminal transaction.
Now, on that part of that, is that... Are those task force rules that they have, like, created internally for operating the task force, or is that based on state statute of some sort?
The task force themselves has a very comprehensive set of guidelines and procedures that we've actually introduced into evidence in this case. And it's extremely important to note that the task force policies and procedures require the following in the event that they work a confidential informant.
I guess what I'm trying to ask more clearly, do those task force rules and procedures and policies rise to the level of a state statute or a rule?
They're how they operate. They are how they are supposed to govern their own work. And it's interesting to note that this is a very unique rule that's very unusual in law. It's a very powerful shield that the state of Texas is allowed to use. We understand that the purpose of this task force and the use of confidential informants to allow essentially these task force to operate on the fringes of law enforcement are given special powers, but they also have special and great responsibilities. The state of Texas wants to use the power of that shield, but have you dispose of the sword that comes with that rule. Now,
I'm thinking in terms of the exclusionary rule, which you can correct me if that's wrong, but you know, even assuming that your theory is correct, how does that play into the guilt or innocence of your client? Isn't there still some fact issues there as to whether, you know, if that scenario was going on, whether your client was still involved in a burglary robbery that turned into a murder?
Well, what's important, Chief Justice, is that the state of Texas has charged a number of people under party theory with capital murder. The only person that shot the man in the head and killed him is charged with no crime. Mr. Mao indicates that he was protecting himself or acting in self-defense. He was involved in the commission of multiple felonies, which would severely impact his ability to ask for self-defense instructions under 9.31. Now, to say that it's not relevant, is shocking. That's just not simply the case. If we can have a witness that can say, you know, I rolled up that guy and he was working as a CI, that provides a separate and distinct motive to the actual uncharged shooter who is the only person to cause the death of Mr. Espino. No one else pulled a trigger, but he's not charged with a crime. If he has a motive that's separate and distinct from any of the actions that the parties were taking, that's certainly relevant for a jury to hear. Now, with regard to the third point of error, the state of Texas complains that the Hays County Narcotics Task Force did not make an election. Clearly, the state of Texas, through its agents, have made an election in this case. On August 19th, 2016, there was an email between the elected district attorney and Wade Parham that clearly and unequivocally indicates an election. Quote, and just in case he asked, I'm not going to reveal which informant made the purchase from Espino in case TF-15-033. It wasn't anyone involved in the homicide. Res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. There's no dispute or reasonable dispute about what that means. Clearly, this was a conversation that the head of the task force thought would presumably be private between himself and the elected district attorney. Clearly, he indicates he knows who the person is, and he's made his own decision outside of the purview of the court that there's no reason to provide that information to the court or to the defense. When analyzing the selection, it's important to note the court's discussion in the findings of facts and conclusions of law, that the court has taken into consideration when analyzing this email the fact that the state exhausted every legal remedy possible to prevent the defense from knowing the identity of the confidential informant, combined with the fact that the testimony of all the Hays County Narcotics Task Force officers lacked credibility. Further, common sense dictates that if it truly were the case, the identity of the informant was unknown, that Commander Parham would have simply disclosed this information on August 19, 2016. The rule itself has a remedy for the state situation. Under 508B, it states that the state, through any of its appropriate agents may claim the confidential informant privilege. But if the state of Texas objects, the court must refute the privilege claim. When the claim was made by Mr. Parham through his affidavit, the state of Texas didn't say, do we really have an informant here? Do we really have a protected privilege here? They drafted the affidavit themselves and had the witness sign it. They brought in the machinations and the procedures of 508. The defense never asked for it. Under 508, once the decision was properly made, and with regard to this Hays County Narcotics Task Force or any task force, I think the state's being disingenuous if they truly believe that having a confidential informant turn the deceased in a drug deal, that his roommate shot him and is not charged with any crime, it's difficult for me to believe that they can't see how that's relevant. And I think most jurors would feel the same way. But they had an avenue to get out of 508, and that was 508B. They did not do so. Then they had an avenue to get out of this situation when they mandamused this court. The court simply stated, we don't know if there's a privilege. They doubled down and said, yes, there is. We want protection from the Court of Criminal Appeals.
How do we review if the state says, look, we didn't have record of his name, but we had identifying characteristics, and we've now given those to you, but we don't know the name? How do we get behind that? And we have this issue in discovery disputes in civil and criminal. When a requesting party requests something, responding party may object and have a fight about it, but then says, ultimately, we don't have this information. How do we get behind that?
That's an excellent question, Justice Field. And the first thing we do is we look at their own rules. And this is a very unique situation where we say, well, what are they supposed to have? Well, let's go look at their own rule book. By their own rules, to work any confidential informant, they're to have a report, a personal history of the confidential informant, a TCIC, NCIC check, a driver's license check, a criminal history background, a photograph of the informant, a signed confidential informant agreement forms, an activity log of their casework. All of this by rule from their own policies and procedures is to be maintained in a safe in Commander Parham's office. More importantly, two detectives are driving this guy around Hays County, giving him taxpayer money to spend on bad acts. That has to be documented as well. The state's position is that they did none of these things. It's important to look at the reasons why the legislature created 508 in the first place. They're discussed in Bowdoin v. State, but essentially, number one, the state needs the ability to continue to use these informants for future law enforcement work. Number two, and most importantly, the safety of the confidential informant must be protected. Their position is, even though we had two guys driving this fellow around the county and all of these things that we were supposed to do and giving him county money, we don't even know who this person is. How does that fulfill the purpose of 508, the legislative intent, by number one, preserving that person's ability to work for law enforcement in the future, or number two, protecting this person? Is the confidential informant alive? Do we know? Have they fulfilled any of the obligations and the legislative intent of 508, or are they simply using it as a shield to attempt to hide bad police work? At this point, we don't know. It doesn't matter to the defense, whether it's by hook or by crook, whether they flat out lied, or whether they're just really, really bad at their jobs. The effect is the same for my client. We are deprived of a material witness that we need for trial. And interestingly enough, the statute does not say simply a reasonable probability that the confidential informant can provide testimony as to innocence.
It says guilt or innocence. Certainly, there's a reasonable probability that this witness can defeat a defensive theory and show that he's guilty if we're wrong. The state of Texas demanded protection under 508 from this court and from the Court of Criminal Appeals. Apparently, the state's position is we're never allowed the identity of this person. We're not allowed it under to determine whether it's exculpatory. We're not allowed this information after a comprehensive hearing that followed to the letter, everything that's involved in 508. And now that the judge has made the determination that there's a reasonable probability that this person can provide information as to guilt or innocence, they want you to create an extrajudicial remedy that simply doesn't exist under the law. They want you to become an activist court, and they want you to create something that simply doesn't exist. Now, they want to say, essentially, that we get a mulligan. We don't know who the person is, and under 508, we want you to completely eliminate any obligations that we have and responsibilities that we have that the legislature has placed upon them.
What is it that they're asking us to do that we would be creating new? I thought that they were asking us to consider basically the trial court's determination that this witness was material.
Correct. And what they're asking...
How is that outside of our usual...
Because under the law, they're simply stating that, well, now at this point, once the judge has made that determination, they still don't have to tell you who the identity is. And the answer is, we don't know.
Okay.
The instruction that this will give law enforcement agencies across the state of Texas is extremely concerning. This will instruct these task force that are sometime known to be rogue agencies to never reveal the identity of a confidential informant. And if the judge calls you to the mat, you just tell him you don't know who it is. For these reasons, I see that my time is short. Reynaldo Lerma prays that you affirm the dismissal of the trial court in this case. And if not, the citizens of Hayes County may ask the same questions that the Roman poet Juvenal asked in his satires a couple thousand years ago when he said, "Who will watch the watchman?"
Thank you, Mr. Irwin. I was giving you grace under the red light. I didn't mean for you to pull out a Roman poet on us. Mr. Mount.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address a couple of the points that counsel made. First, he argued that the state, in our point of error, has suggested that the in-camera hearing was error. We have never argued that. I've never suggested that the court erred in conducting the in-camera hearing. What I've suggested is that the court erred in making the finding that justified the in-camera hearing, that being that there was a reasonable probability established that the confidential informant was a material witness in the case. Having made that erroneous finding, then yes, I also objected to the judge ordering disclosure without having done the in-camera hearing that the Rule 508 requires. That's what the mandamus was about. The judge, of course, then agreed to hold that 508 hearing prior to the Court of Criminal Appeals ruling on that issue. Second, he argues that the state refused to look and see if there was any exculpatory information in the file. That is simply false. There is no evidence that that is the case. There is no evidence that any exculpatory information exists, whether the state found it or not. There is no evidence that the state did not seek to find out whether there was any exculpatory information. That, frankly, that's an assault on my character as a prosecutor. It has nothing to do with this case, because it's whether or not exculpatory information exists, it still does not deal with the issue of whether or not this confidential informant was a material witness in this case. When counsel got up here and talked to you for the entire 20 minutes that he was up here, did he ever once say anything to you about what this confidential informant would be able to testify to that would be material to the guilt or innocence of the defendant in this case? He suggests that, well, he could be a witness to counter their argument that the confidential informant told the roommate and the roommate therefore had a motive to commit the murder. That's what Williams v. State talks about. That's mentioned in the brief. In Williams v. State, the officers involved there during the in-camera hearing told the court they had no knowledge of whether the informant could give testimony regarding the guilt or innocence of the suspects, that is insufficient to justify disclosure of the informant. Just because the police say we don't know whether he would say something or not, that's not proof that he has material evidence to give. And in the absence of that proof, Rule 508 requires that disclosure not be ordered. And that's I think, the point that the defense is missing here, that the appellee is missing here, is Rule 508 is a special rule. It is a special rule to protect people who provide information to the police and help the police. How he thinks disclosing that to a person who has committed a home invasion robbery would somehow benefit the confidential informant's safety, would somehow provide the confidential informant with incentive to give more information to the police, is mystifying to me. Whether those records are lost or not, whether that confidential informant's identity has been lost or not, that's certainly protecting his identity. If the records are destroyed, that protects it as well as it can be protected. I'm not suggesting that's what the police did here, and I'm certainly not suggesting that would be an appropriate policy. But what I'm suggesting here is that throughout this case, the state was consistent in their argument. This goes to his waiver argument. We were consistently telling the court that there is only conjecture, there is only speculation to justify disclosure here. Every time we suggested that, the court agreed with it and said, Rule 508 be damned, I'm ordering it disclosed anyway. That is what is wrong. That is where the court erred, and that is the problem that's going to result if this case is not reversed, is because how can the police give an assurance to a confidential informant that when you give us information, when you do a controlled buy, your name will be kept out of it? And in fact, that's what they always do. They do these controlled buys, they destroy the drugs, they don't prosecute the seller because they want to keep the confidential informant confidential. They collect that information, they do another controlled buy, they get another set of information, then they go and do a warrant. You see that there's a plethora of cases in which the police have used confidential informants to get information about whether there were drugs in a particular place held by a particular person. They get a warrant, they go after that person, and the confidential informant is not involved. Just as here, when this crime occurred, the confidential informant was not involved. How can the police assure informants that your identity will remain confidential, you will not be brought into this, you will not be placed in the kind of danger that you will be in if your name got out, if the mere fact that the person you informed against might some months later be involved in a completely separate crime as a victim means that your identity has to be turned over? That is ridiculous. That is the irony that Sotelo points out. That if a ride along in a DWI case whose information is lost doesn't have to be disclosed when there isn't a special statute protecting him, then how is it that confidential informants can be entitled to less protection? If the court doesn't reverse this case, Rule 508 be damned indeed.
Thank you, Mr. Mount, Mr. Irwin. Both of you, well-argued case. The case will be submitted, and you all can be excused. Thanks to our students who came.